You know the saying, so many books, so little time? Well, if you've got an hour, we've got a page-turner for you with a trip to the library on today's edition of the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. Gobbled up any good books during this pandemic period? So have we. From ideas about voting and civic duty, the untold story of a war often repeatedly revisited, an agent of change who might otherwise have been lost to history, the tale of a Texas music scene that breaks all the stereotypes, and loving sports when they don't love you back. Conversations with authors from across the Lone Star State and beyond as we hit the bookshelves for a very special edition of the Texas Standard. The next chapter begins right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this Wednesday, November 25th, a day before Thanksgiving, and we're thankful you're spending a bit of your time with us. With the pressure off somewhat for the usual feast preparations, what with warnings to avoid big gatherings and such, you just might be spending this Thanksgiving with a book, or two, or three. After all, a book is a garden, an orchard, a storehouse, a party, a company, by the way, a counselor, a multitude of counselors. But that was just Baudelaire talking. More recently, author Mallory Blackman offered an even more persuasive and perhaps timely rationale for reading. Consuming a good book, she says, is an exercise in empathy. But it can also be a healthy workout of sorts, for if Joseph Addison is correct, reading is to the mind what exercise is to the body. If it seems we've been getting a workout in 2020, you're quite right. This hour we'll be spending some time with the authors of some memorable books we've encountered since the start of 2020, a year distinguished, or maybe not so much, by a certain general election. Though few of us have the stomach to relive one of the most contentious and ugliest campaign seasons in modern memory, it is worth noting that Texas distinguished itself this year for record turnout and early voting. But even before the vote was in, Liberty, Texas native Aaron Geiger Smith was offering an appreciation of those doing their civic duty at the polls. She's the author of Thank You for Voting, The Maddening, Enlightening, Inspiring Truth About Voting in America. When we talked in October, Aaron was cautiously optimistic about turnout.
What I hoped when I began researching the book, what I would discover this one big problem and we could just solve that one and we would be off. But the truth is, of course, that it's a ton of reasons. There's barriers for some people. There are many reasons that young people specifically stay home. So young people are ages 18 to 29 have really low turnout. And that's what I spent a lot of time looking at in the book. And a lot of people think it's apathy, but it's really not. Young people care a ton about their education and being able to get a job and maybe climate change. And especially in 2018, there was a large focus on safety in schools. But what I really felt like was that we're not doing a good job of teaching people how to vote. And that if we can make that a much greater focus, we would see larger turnout in that younger age group. And if you start voting when you're young, you become a lifelong voter. So that, I think, it's failure to teach the mechanics and then not making voting as convenient as possible. You know, long registration cutoffs. So states like Texas that cut off voter registration, you know, 30 days before the election, whereas some states have same-day registration. I think we need to look at those factors of convenience and try to do better about working those in into our system.
I wonder, though, how much about the system itself becomes a kind of psychological impediment. There are some folks who say, well, my vote doesn't count because of, for instance, the Electoral College. Does that notion have merit when it comes to thinking about why people do or don't choose to vote?
I think it absolutely does. A question that I get over and over is, I live in an all red state or I live in an all blue state. What does it matter if I vote? And that also goes to the fact that we don't do a great job of explaining that the Electoral College matters only about the president, and you are going to vote up and down the ballot. So even if you live in an all red state or an all blue state, your vote very much matters in all of the elections below the presidential election. And we need to talk more about that. Politicians, unfortunately, focus much more on those people who show up. So even if you're in the minority, if you're voting for the minority candidate, the biggest number of people that are voting for that minority candidate, the more their ideas and beliefs and needs will be paid attention to. So I think trying to teach this idea of you're not just voting for president, you have to look at your senators, your congressmen, and very much your congresspeople, excuse me, very much your state legislatures and your mayors and city council people and school board. I think if the coronavirus has taught us anything, it's that local and state officials have a huge effect on our lives.
Let's talk a little bit about the lone elector from Liberty County, Art Cisneros, in the Electoral College. Tell us a little bit more about why you wanted to focus on that, other than your knowledge of Liberty, Texas, being a native daughter.
Right. Well, I have to say that from a writing perspective, that was just a lucky break. That's probably not the best term for it. But I wanted to learn more about the Electoral College. You know, I went to law school and I was a legal reporter. And then after 2016, I realized I know how it works, but I don't know a lot of its details. And so one of my first questions was, who are these electors? And though it turns out they're mostly party faithful, so that answer itself wasn't so exciting. But when I found the story of the elector from my home district, that he was one of the few who just said, I can't vote for who I said I was supposed to vote for, and resigned. There are what they call faithless electors, which is kind of a harsh term, but, you know, it's not completely uncommon that someone decides to vote, use their electoral college vote for the person who didn't win the popular vote in their state, but it's rare enough that it hasn't made a big difference. So Art Cisneros was from the small town right next to mine, and he resigned from being elector right before, a few weeks before they voted in 2016. But the way that turns out is they pretty much just choose someone else from the district and it moves on. So I loved that it highlighted both the importance of the Electoral College and the weight it can have, and then at the same time that it's a pretty predictable procedural event.
People feel so powerfully about the Electoral College, and it I suppose that there are critics who say that it often depends, you know, ideas about the Electoral College often depend upon who's running and which party is in power and that sort of thing. The Electoral College is an innovation, and I put that in air quotes, to the extent that it is supposed to, in a sense, give states at least more power in the electoral process, especially those states with smaller populations. How well served are we, in your estimation, by the Electoral College?
You know, that answer depends a whole lot on where you live. If you live in one of these states that have a powerful Electoral College voice, mostly because they're swing states, then you feel like it serves a lot of importance and it serves you well. It gives your state a lot of power and a lot of focus in the presidential election. But if you live in a state where things are pretty predictable, it can feel really unfortunate. And I think if you are in the minority group of voters in those swing states, then it probably feels pretty painful. And in states like Texas, where you have more than 40% of the people voting for the losing candidate in 2016, for example, all of those votes just get tossed to the side. And there's obviously a reasonable argument that that isn't serving that enormous group of people in places like Texas. On the other hand, if you're in the majority party in Texas, even by the smallest of margins, then you have a lot of incentive to keep it. So the feelings on the Electoral College are complicated.
Doesn't this, though, come down to an essential undemocratic character of America's democratic process, in the sense that since the beginning, that process has largely been a winner-takes-all proposition? If you are in the 51%, you win. You get the whole bag. If you are not in that 51%, you don't. I mean, this is something that seems to be inherent. Even without the Electoral College, there's a question about should a large minority still lose it all.
Yeah, from a purely democratic question, there's no doubt that many, many, many American citizens aren't served by the Electoral College. And the reasons for which it is created really don't hold a lot of water anymore. But the truth is, changing it will mean that there's going to have to be consensus and agreement to change from those people who are served by it. I think one thing that we as Americans don't think a lot about the Electoral College, but is sort of helpful in thinking about potential changes, is that there have been more than 700, I believe at the last count by an organization called Fair Vote, proposals to change the Electoral College. And sometimes Congress has supported it, and sometimes the Senate has supported it, but it's never happened at the same time. So it's not like the idea of change is a really far-fetched one. And further, how states allocate their Electoral College votes is not by any means set in stone. So states can allocate them how they want, and if they chose to split them up depending on the popular vote turnout in their state, they can do that. So how we use the Electoral College isn't something that has to be forever and ever the way that we do it now. And one of the potential changes is this compact between states where they will allocate their Electoral College votes to the popular vote winner, even if that doesn't match in their state. And I think it's at about 19 states that have signed on to that, and it doesn't go into effect until the number of states in the agreement have 270 votes. That would, of course, be what you need to win president. So it's not something that's super close, but it's an interesting movement that would get around the idea of having to have a constitutional amendment. But I think, you know, it'll be very interesting to see if the Electoral College vote and the popular vote don't match up several elections in a row. One has to guess that won't sit well with a lot of Americans, but usually they match up and people move on with their lives and don't worry about it. So that's kind of, I think, how we've had it so long.
An important primer on voting in an important election year, Erin Geiger-Smith explores America's voting processes in her new book, Thank You for Voting, The Maddening, Enlightening, Inspiring Truth About Voting in America. Erin, I wish we had more time. Thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org.
This is Lee Bird from El Paso, Texas. I am a publisher. My husband and I started Cinco Puntos Press 35 years ago. I'm a writer of novels and fiction, but I also have these beautiful grandkids. I have 7 of them, and I've written stories for each one of them, mostly. I have 3 more to go, but this book, Birdie's Beauty Parlor, is about Emma, Birdie Bird, and when she was young, she's now 20, she's the sort of girl that when I was taking care of her, I would get a little tired, as grandmas sometimes do. And I would say, Emma, let's do beauty parlor. And so our way of doing beauty parlor was for me to lie down on the bed and for her to just take every single piece of makeup I had and lay it on me. And it never lasted long enough for me. She got tired sooner than I was ready. But it was always the most wonderful experience. And you end up not looking too beautiful, but covered up with makeup. I wanted to commemorate that in this book. And every time I see the Francisco's illustration on the cover with Birdie's big red lips and her pigtails flying out, I just love it. And I love that she's so dang bossy. I just love the way she throws things around, and she pushes her grandmother around, and she grabs her grandmother's face and pulls the hair chins out. That was always the granddaughter's work, was to look at her grandmother and say, "Grandma, you've got hairs on your chin." And so that was what I threw in there too. Now, the reason Francisco Delgado did this book is he and I also did another book together. The first book we did together was Juanito Counts to Ten, and that was about my grandson, John Andrew. John Andrew is very affectionate, so it was about counting kisses. And instead of using John Andrew as a model, Francisco used his son, Pedro, because Pedro was there, and that was how it went. So I don't think we said, well, we need a kid of color, we need anything. So that's how we work together. He uses his kids to model, and I use my grandchildren as the inspiration. Kids, especially around here, and kids all throughout the Southwest, they don't want to see Little Red Riding Hood or in Spanish. They want to see their own cultural stories. And that it was bilingual made a lot of sense. Now, we have done books in English and in Spanish as like a dual edition, but they never sold as well for us. The bilingual books have always been the best selling books, and so we just wanted Birdie's Beauty Parlor to be bilingual, so it's all about grandmas and granddaughters. This is Lee Bird. I'm the author of Birdie's Beauty Parlor, and I am listening, as always, to the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider. Proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. You caught us in the library. This hour, we're revisiting our favorite book interviews from 2020. Some of these books taking us back in time and connecting the present with the past. There's a weight of history attached to place names like Gettysburg, Shiloh, and Antietam. For those who know American history, they conjure images and emotions in a way that perhaps places like Valverde, Glorieta Pass, and Mesilla do not. But those names have something in common. They're all Civil War battle sites. The difference is that the latter three took place in the West. The war's Western theater seldom gets as much attention as those battles in the East, but historian Megan Kate Nelson could help change that with a new perspective on America's bloodiest conflict. Her book is The Three-Cornered War: The Union, the Confederacy, and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. Megan, this story takes place a long way from the central theater of the Civil War. Why was control of the Southwest still regarded as hugely important by both the Union and the Confederacy? Could you explain that?
For the Confederacy, they really wanted access, particularly to California. They wanted access to gold mines so they could fund their war effort. And they wanted access to the Pacific ports of California because they needed to be able to export their cotton. And already in the first summer of the war, the Union was becoming quite successful at blockading their ports along the Gulf and the Southeast. And so for the Confederacy, this was a place, and all the area kind of west of Texas was a corridor through which they could march and really be able to fuel the rest of their campaign against the Union.
But I think we should bring in the third corner here, because not much has been discussed about Native Americans and their involvement in the Civil War. You know, you think about how many Indians were marched westward under President Jackson, and I would imagine that in some sense, at least, the Confederacy and joining or being sympathetic to the Confederacy would have been seen as an opportunity to get back at the United States, which forced so many of these tribes to leave their lands.
Oh, certainly. And there were several tribes in Indian Territory, which, of course, is on Texas' northern border, who did throw in with the Confederacy, who did fight for them for that very reason, and because those particular groups were slave-owning. So they found common cause with the Confederacy. The tribes of the Southwest, Comanches and Apaches and Navajos in particular, had a more complicated relationship both with the federal government and then also with the Confederates. Mostly these groups saw what, you know, they termed the white man's war as an opportunity, because here for the first time there were these long wagon trains and these huge beef herds and abundant mules and horses. And for Native communities in the Southwest, those animals were the kind of backbone of their trade in the region. And so they started raiding both Union and Confederate wagon trains and siphoning off animals, because in their view, these were foreign entities marching large armies through their territory.
Dr. Nelson, what made you interested in revisiting this particular chapter of history? I mean, one obvious thought that occurs to me is that really people haven't talked about the Civil War as more than North versus South, at least the, you know, in popular culture.
Exactly. Yeah, that was part of my interest. I wrote a book about the Civil War before this and focused mostly on the Southeastern theater. And as I was researching that book, I sort of discovered that there were these conflicts in New Mexico territory. And I was amazed, because I grew up in Colorado, and there were Colorado soldiers who fought in these conflicts against Baylor and his Texans. And I had never heard of that. And so I was interested not only in what had happened, but also why it has been erased in American memory. Because if you look at any Civil War textbook now, or any kind of broader Civil War text, if you look at the map of the war, it actually ends, its western border is in central Texas. And so I think it convinces Americans that, well, you know, if it's not on the map, could anything really have happened there that was important?
But it was indeed an important theater, and one with many stories to tell. Megan Kate Nelson tells them as author and historian in a new book, The Three-Cornered War: The Union, the Confederacy, and Native Peoples in the Fight for the West. Dr. Nelson, thanks so much for spending a little time with us on the Texas Standard. I wish we had more time. It's a really interesting book.
Well, great. Well, thanks so much for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Public health experts in Texas say it's vital to modify Thanksgiving plans as coronavirus cases keep surging. Dr. Charles Lerner is with the Texas Medical Association's COVID-19 Task Force. He says the safest way to celebrate is with immediate household members.
And first and foremost, you must remember that your family, who does not live in your household, are not your household contacts.
Lerner says while there is no safe way to eat with people from another household, there are ways to reduce risk. His recommendations include dining outdoors and wearing a mask when not eating, he adds.
You should not have a common serving spoon, because when you do, you're passing contamination from hand to hand to hand. If you can't do that, then have one person serve everybody.
Ahead of the holiday, the state hit a new daily record for COVID-19 cases Tuesday, with nearly 14,000 infections. Small Business Saturday is this weekend, and Governor Greg Abbott is encouraging Texans to shop local, whether it be online or in person.
As our state continues to respond to COVID-19, these businesses, they need our support more than ever. That's why I encourage all Texans to join me in celebrating and supporting our entrepreneurs and small businesses on Saturday, November the 28th, and throughout the entire holiday season.
He says Texans shopping in person should do it safely by wearing face masks, frequently sanitizing their hands, and social distancing. Texas military families are struggling with food insecurity at a higher rate than their counterparts across the U.S. TPR's Carson Frame reports a survey from the Military Family Advisory Network found 1 in 6 military and veteran respondents in the state were hungry or experiencing low food security even before the pandemic.
Most respondents were from the Army and the Air Force. Nearly half of the families who reported food insecurity were active duty, followed by veterans and retirees. Shelley Kimball is the Senior Director of Military and Program Evaluation with the Military Family Advisory Network. She says one of the survey's findings was especially disturbing.
The key here among our Texas respondents was that they were more likely to limit food or not eat than to seek assistance or to seek those financial solutions. And so we found that kind of distressing, that instead of seeking help, they were just remaining hungry.
The Military Family Advisory Network will conduct a follow-up study in January with help from UT Austin. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
And I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. We're taking a bit of time this day before Thanksgiving to look back at some memorable author interviews we've done in 2020. This year, a South Texas icon long overlooked by historians finally got her proper due in a new biography. Adela Sloss Vento was an important writer, a feminist, an activist, and a leader who helped pave the way toward equal rights in the lower Rio Grande Valley. The biography, titled Agent of Change, dives into Adela's upbringing and her important role as a civil rights activist throughout the Mexican-American and Chicano movement. Its author is Cynthia Orozco. She is professor of history and humanities at Eastern New Mexico University. Professor Orozco, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the subject of your new biography, Adela Sloss Vento. How is it that she has somehow been missing from so many history books?
Well, it's kind of ironic because in 1977, she actually wrote a book, and you would have thought that once somebody has written a book, their name gets out there a little bit. But unfortunately, she did not conduct a book tour. She was about 75 years old when she published her book, and two newspapers reported the publication of the book. But otherwise, the general public basically did not find out about it. And most academics also were unaware of it. And those who did see her book mostly ignored it, maybe because it was self-published and maybe because she was a woman.
Adela Sloss Vento becomes this lost historical figure, but clearly she wound up on your radar screen. Tell us a little bit about why she was so influential throughout South Texas.
Well, the first thing to know about her is that she graduated from high school in the mid-20s, which was very unusual for any Mexican-American, and especially for women. Shortly after she graduated, she connected to the men who were organizing what was going to become the LULAC, League of United Latin American Citizens, and she cared about immigrants. She was actually a jail matron, so she worked with prisoners and she worked with poor people. And she started writing about desegregating the schools and desegregating public facilities.
And how did she fight? How did she fight that? I mean, what forms of resistance did her action take?
Well, first of all, she wrote numerous newspaper articles, English and Spanish, against segregated schools. In the 1940s, there were a couple of major bills at the Texas legislature that were trying to make that kind of segregation and racism illegal, but there was not enough support. There weren't any Mexican Americans in office. So it was very difficult because they needed a major change of public opinion that we're really not going to get until the 60s. So she nonetheless protested through her writing. Also, we call her a feminist because she wrote about how Hispanic women were slaves in the home. So she was advocating for them to participate in civic organizations, particularly Ladies LULAC, which were segregated councils for women in LULAC.
She obviously sounds like a unique person who had a distinct vision about rights and freedom. And yet,
yes,
you think about the way that history is taught in Texas, even in the Rio Grande Valley, and I think a lot of people would say that they have never heard the name Adela Sloss Vento.
Oh, you know, that's true, but unfortunately, it's also true that LULAC, League of United Latin American Citizens, often is barely in Texas history books. J.T. Canales, who is one of the founders of LULAC and was a state representative, and actually he filed 19 charges against the Texas Rangers, he's hardly in the Texas books. Texas history books need to upgrade and include.
Now, I understand that early in your career worked closely with and had a personal relationship with Adela?
Yes. Actually, when I was a sophomore at UT Austin, I took my first Chicano history class, and I was very interested in conducting original research. So her son was working at UT Austin, and he introduced me to her. He told me she had just written a book, and so I used her archives way back. But unfortunately, at the time, she only talked about the male leaders and never told me that she, too, was so important to this effort.
We've been talking about Adela Sloss Vento. Cynthia Orozco is author of Agent of Change, Adela Sloss Vento. It's out now. Professor Orozco, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, bringing cancer-fighting treatments and 300 open clinical trials to 26,000 patients in Austin each year so they have access to care near the support of their loved ones. More at texasoncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town while keeping safety in mind. Shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions like Moody Gardens and more. Details at galveston.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Remember Devo? Are We Not Men? D-E-V-O. Long about that time in a Texas of 40 years ago, a photojournalism student decided to take pictures of an explosive music scene springing up at bars near the University of Texas campus. It was a scene decidedly at odds with the general mainstream music trends. A do-it-yourself music scene with a snarl and an aesthetic reminiscent of the punk rockers of New York and London years earlier, only somehow even more subversive, rebellious, and relentless in its attack on Texas tropes. Photojournalist Pat Blaschel, who's traveled the globe documenting rock and roll, says the images of an almost forgotten music scene in Texas captures an emotional power unrivaled among his collection of images. He's gathered those impressions together in a book titled Texas is the Reason, The Mavericks of Lone Star Punk. And in it, a picture emerges of a seldom seen Texas, one of chaos and a sense of community, anger, and barely bridled aggression.
Yeah, it was loud and it was sweaty and intense. I want to be a problem. There were some very real things that people were rebelling against and sort of screaming about. These scenes were happening all over the U.S. The difference with Texas was there wasn't this, you know, intense media, news, or Hollywood or advertising industries in our town, in Austin. So it had a chance to kind of fester and grow on its own and be its own thing. And I think that that was an advantage, because then I think the scene was much more unusual and it became much more unique and diverse.
Let's talk about some of the stars of this movement. Most never really went on to be household names, although one or two, yes, did sort of emerge on the national scene. Yes. We're a family-friendly show, so I'll just refer to them as the Beehole Surfers. That was probably one. But you write that everyone sort of saw them coming in a way, right? I mean, y'all figured that this would be a big deal.
I thought they were the best band on the planet, you know, in those days. I thought that that was indisputable. They combined such a clever, thought-out concept of just shock, but also a blend of like noise and melody and sort of really very traditional rock elements with this punk sort of noise and energy.
Oh,
And there were other bands that had sort of regional reputations like Scratch Acid, Poison 13. Poison 13 is credited by a lot of the grunge musicians in Seattle as being a super big influence on them. So people like Pearl Jam, Mudhoney, Nirvana, they were all listening to the sounds from Austin.
Do you think there was something uniquely Texan about what was happening in the punk scene at Rolls and other joints? Or do you think that this was something more universal somehow?
I think there was something uniquely Texan. I think that the things that we were angry about, especially racism, the things that we were sort of trying to resist or scream about, religious conservatism, bigotry, keen awareness of some of the pressures of being in a college town with a very active and conservative Greek community. Some of the bands, they were kind of playing with the idea that Texans are these kind of backwards, slack-jawed yokels, you know, that we were hillbillies.
What's the matter, little feller? Ain't you never seen a cross-dresser before? Well, he's queen.
Many of us were artists, and we were aware and cognizant of how to put together an interesting concept in art. But we also realized that many people around the U.S. think that Texans are all crazy.
A lot of these figures that were part of this scene went on to do other things in arts and letters and music, of course. Yeah. I'm wondering, as you think about the reverberations from that little corner of the Texas capital city.
Yeah.
How do you see the reverberations?
Well, a lot of the people that came out of our scene and our group of people, they may not have, you know, had great success or been in the New York Times, but I think of my friend Donna, who's like an excellent psychotherapist, or I think of Chris Gates, who played bass for the Big Boys, and he's now leading sobriety and 12-step meetings. And these are people, to me, that are sort of everyday heroes. And they're doing things that are, I don't know, that are just very human. They're very sort of human, wonderful, caring things that I think come out of some of what we were sort of working through and processing as we made this loud music and I made these pictures. And I don't know. I think a lot about what the musician Ian MacKay has said about punk, and he thinks that it's about being human to each other. I like that. I think that really sums it up.
It's hard to try not to imagine what this scene might be if it were possible in modern times. And mm-hmm. yet it's impossible to imagine this reemerging in modern times because there's the social media outlets for the kind of angst and anxieties and pressures that a lot of young people feel even today.
Yes. Yes.
Do you think it's possible for something like this to happen somewhere, maybe even in Texas in 2020, or is this in a way a snapshot of another time when that sort of thing was impossible?
I think it's happening right now. I think it's happening in a lot of different ways, and it might look slightly different, but I just got an email from somebody who wants to talk to me about Latino punk, and he showed me some pictures that he's taking, and they look like they're made in the last few months, and it looks like at least some of them were made in New York City. And I mean, you know, it's kind of the same stuff, but you got people in a mosh pit wearing masks because there's been the lockdown. But other than that, they're like doing the same thing. So once again, it may mean that those bands are never well known, but in their town, if you want to have a good time and get sloppy and slam dance with people and have that kind of essential, vital human contact with other peoples, you can do it. I mean, you can find it. I think that, yes, social media has changed the way that sort of the broad waves of communication happen all over the world, but locally, I think this sort of stuff still happens, and it's still really important to people to be able to express themselves in this way.
Pat Blaschel is the author of a new book, Texas is the Reason, The Mavericks of Lone Star Punk. He's also the photographer, and these images are truly stirring, definitely worth checking out. Pat, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. That was really fun.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown, and this hour we've been catching up with some of our favorite books by or about Texans. This year, the sports world certainly looked and felt different from any other, with concerns over COVID, season shortened or canceled altogether. But it was also a year of social change within the sports industry, as discussions of racial and gender equity took center stage, both in and out of the arena. Amid these reckonings, many sports lovers found themselves struggling with how to personally justify their fandom in an industry that can be at odds with their ethical beliefs. These are themes Austin-based sports journalist Jessica Luther explores in her book, co-authored with Kavitha A. Davidson. It's called Loving Sports When They Don't Love You Back, Dilemmas of the Modern Fan. Jessica, as a sports journalist and sports fan, I'm wondering if there was a particular moment where you realized sports didn't love you back and made you sort of examine or rethink why you were a fan.
So if anyone knows me from anything, it's probably my reporting on gendered violence in sports, specifically college football and sexual assault, even more specifically Baylor. Mm-hmm. And doing that work over the years really drove all of these things home. It's very hard for me now to watch college football in particular, but just seeing the way that institutions respond to gendered violence has made it hard for me. At the same time, I think there's a way that as a woman who loves sports, as a girl who loves sports, you're always kind of positioned as an outsider. You always have to prove your knowledge. You have to prove that you care, that you know what you're talking about. And that's kind of like the microaggression of being a female sports fan. I'm sure that other marginalized people have similar stuff. So I think it's kind of just been part of my life, but definitely over the last few years with the kind of specific reporting that I end up doing.
I'm just curious, was there a particular sport or sports that you happen to follow more than others?
My favorite sport right now and has been for a long time is tennis.
So tennis.
I love tennis.
Did you find that there were issues in tennis that caused you to?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
So there's actually a chapter in the book on racism, classism, and sexism in tennis. And it's funny. Tennis is funny for me because I know all those things and I care about them deeply. Serena Williams, I'm a big fan of hers, and she deals with all of this stuff all of the time. Mm-hmm. At the same time, as a fan, a lot of the times I don't want to know anything. I want to be ignorant. I don't want to know anything about these people. I just want to watch them as athletes and not care about the things that they believe politically or say about all of these issues that I care about. Tennis is a difficult one for me, but I do happen to know a fair amount about it that I wish tennis would do better.
But you're speaking to something that it's a dilemma for a lot of people. It's easy to sort of castigate someone for not being as morally upright as you are or what have you. But what you're speaking to is this idea that you want to love something. You want to engage and appreciate in certain aspect of something. And I think a lot of people sort of think, well, there's always going to be a segment of fans that have a stick-to-sports mindset. There's something much more complicated going on, it strikes me.
Yeah, I think fandom is a really complicated thing, in part because, especially around sports, this is true in other kinds of fandom, but especially with sports, there's a lot of personal identity involved. The story I always tell is that I only applied to go to college at one university, which was Florida State. That's where I went because I grew up as a Florida State football fan, and I wanted to watch Florida State football. And that was part of how I imagined myself. Mm-hmm. And so your identity is tied into all of these things. At the same time, there's so many facets to who you are. And oftentimes, sport can be a really exclusive place where only certain people are allowed in and are allowed to be fans. And you end up feeling that, and it's pushing. So you want to be in, you want to be in the community, but you're also getting these other parts of you that are trying to assert themselves, and reconciling all of that all of the time. When you just love sports, love to watch them, can be, yeah, as you said, it can be a very complicated process.
So how do you reconcile those challenges, those difficulties?
Yeah, there's lots of different ways, and I think everyone sort of has to draw their own line. I think, you know, we talk to people in the book, especially like in the gendered violence chapter, people who, you know, donate money whenever the pitcher who's throwing the ball, they donate money to a local domestic violence shelter if that person has been accused of domestic violence, like it's like an offset or something. Mm-hmm. You have these difficult conversations with your friends. I've had very tense moments with friends and family discussing these things that I care about. And, you know, you put pressure on the corporations or the people, you know, if you're an alum, you write to your university and you tell them how you feel about the choices that they're making. So there are like active steps you can take, but also it's just you coming to terms with what you can handle as a consumer and as a fan.
You talk about having these difficult conversations with friends and family, and I think that that is an experience that a lot of people, a lot of sports fans, indeed, a lot of people in from any variety of human endeavor have struggled with, most certainly now. Indeed, this book feels perhaps more timely than ever. When you do encounter someone who doesn't take kindly to social criticism within the sports world, how do you reach those people? Do you try? Do you think the mindset is changing? How do you approach that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think this is true with all these kinds of conversations that we're, lots of people are struggling through, not just around sports. Sometimes you just have to let it go. You're not going to win them over. I definitely had my share of that. At the same time, I do think a lot of people only know so much about something, and often just having more knowledge about it can help. So presenting it as like, hey, did you know, instead of like, you're wrong, can often work in your favor. I mean, we wrote a whole book where we basically do that, right? That's kind of the approach of the book in general. And I think you just have to, you know, the sort of cliche statement of like meeting people where they are, recognizing that people do care very deeply in a very personal way about these issues and often feel implicated as fans when you're talking to them about these things. So meeting them where they are and starting the conversation there and recognizing that often it's just that you don't have all the same information as other people and that you're not always going to win everyone over to your side, right? Everyone's going to have a variety of opinions on these things.
I mentioned that this book feels more timely than ever, and that's certainly true given the NBA boycott and questions on how sports leagues will handle operations in the middle of this pandemic, to say nothing of the larger social issues that we are dealing with right now, a kind of moment of reckoning as it's been described by some. What do you hope people will take away from this book?
I hope that for a lot of people, one of their takeaways will be that there are a lot of us out here who often love sports but feel like maybe sports doesn't love them back, that they're not alone in that. At the same time, I hope people take away new information about all these different issues and really what we want. I mean, Kavitha and I are huge sports fans, and I think the dedication to the book just says we want sports to be better. I hope that people can see that you can be a critical fan and still be a fan, and that the overall point of it all is to just make the sports umbrella bigger and more inclusive and have more people feel like they are part of it.
Jessica Luther is a Texas-based sports journalist and co-author of Loving Sports When They Don't Love You Back, along with Kavitha A. Davidson. Jessica, thanks so much for your time and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a special edition of the Texas Standard as we've revisited some of our favorite Texas books and authors from the past year. As Toni Morrison once said, if there's a book that you want to read but it hasn't been written yet, you must be the one to write it. As always, we're waiting to hear from you. Texas Standard at KUT.org or anytime at TexasStandard.org. We're awfully grateful you could join us on this Wednesday. On behalf of the entire Texas Standard team, I'm David Brown wishing you and yours a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Additional philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Ben Benson Family Fund.